Welcome to the Evolved Caveman, where men learn to be successful and happy with your host, Dr. John Schinnerer, as he shares the most impactful ideas and practices for you to get the most from your relationships, your work, and from your life. Now here's Dr. John.
Hey everybody, this is Dr. John back with the latest episode of the Evolved Caveman, and today I am really excited to have with me here, John Rennie. John is a former Cold War nuclear submarine officer turned CEO, and he's led 8 manufacturing businesses in corporate America for 22 years before starting his own manufacturing business in 2016. He writes and speaks on leadership issues and hosts the Deep Leadership podcast. His latest book is I Have the Watch, Becoming a Leader Worth Following, which is an Amazon bestseller. And you can find out more information at johnsrennie.com, and that's johnsrennie.com, and we'll have those and some more links in the show notes, and we'll cover some more of those later on. John, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for joining me.
Sure.
How are you surviving this whole coronavirus episode, pandemic?
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, my wife's a teacher now. She's had to set up remote teaching from the house for her kindergarten kids, which is very interesting. Mm-hmm. For me, we lead a business that is selling products or manufacturing products for the electric utility industry, which is considered critical infrastructure. So we're still here. We're still manufacturing, and we're taking care of our customers to make sure that we keep the lights on. So in the middle of all this, we got to make sure the grid is, providing power to everybody as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting. I know that here in California, in our local school district, we were just talking with some people about providing some mental health support to teachers locally, because they're just expected to deal with so much fires, school shootings, pandemics, and they're never really offered any mental health support, nor how to deal with it for their kids. And now they're saying, well, just teach online, teach virtually. And it's like, and there's some technology fear for many of them. And so that's an interesting question as well. So to get us kicked off, tell me a story of what you look like at your very best, kind of where you've gone through a struggle and then emerged triumphant over that struggle.
Yeah, I would say my first opportunity to lead a manufacturing plant, I was just 32 years old, and I had a boss that felt that I had the leadership skills to take on something significant like a manufacturing plant, of which I had never done before. And, coming in as a young leader and being surrounded by people that had been at that plant as many years as I'd been alive, and trying to be an effective leader in that kind of environment. And I made a lot of dumb mistakes as a young leader, thinking that I had all the knowledge, I had all the experience. I was promoted to a leader, so I must have known a lot, right? But I found that while people were good and they allowed me to make mistakes, they were patient with me as I was trying to get my feet underneath me. What I learned through that process is you've gotta listen more. You gotta respect the people that have been there for years. You have to engage them. And then when I made that shift, that pivot to where I was much more of a listener, much more of getting people involved in the process, the business, the people sort of rallied around me as a leader. The business took off. We performed at a very high level, and we set records for the business, and it was just an amazing and fun place to work. But I kind of came in guns a blazing, and through that I learned how to kind of tone it back a little bit, listen to the people, the experts, the people that have been there a long time, engage them, engage their brains, their ideas, get that into the business. And when we did that, things completely changed, and we became a very successful business because I focused on the people. And that's probably where my early experience of being involved. I say in my book that leadership is a people business, and I think it came from those early days of trying to learn how to lead and trying to do it on my own, and then realize I need a team to be able to do it.
Yeah, I think those are all great lessons to take away. It's fascinating you say that. I'm 32, I'm promoted to leader, and I thought I knew a lot. And I think that's often the mistake we make going in. And I think, especially as men, like we're socialized to know and to problem solve and be analytical. Mm-hmm. And then we get into leadership positions. And I think it's less about knowing and more about building rapport and trust and connection. I mean, how much does the emotional piece come into this in your learning in terms of leadership?
Well, I think, I don't know about emotional, but I would say definitely empathy, right? So, you know, one of the experiences that I had just coming from the Navy and being in the submarine community where it was very tight, we got to know the people that we worked with very intimately, right? Because you spent 80 days together, you know, locked in a submarine, you know, and I did that 7 different times in my life. So almost 2 years under the water. And, You built these deep relationships. And I think, you know, leading in business is the same thing. You have to have those deep relationships. So you have to be very empathetic towards the people that you're working with. And so, yeah, there's an emotional connection too, as well. I mean, you celebrate with your employees when things are going well. You know, you grieve when they have family members that die, and you go to their, you know, you go to the funerals, and so you're there for those people. You know, and so you have these deep relationships, and it's just like in a family relationship, you have the emotions that sometimes are happy, sometimes are sad, sometimes you're laughing. So I think leadership is about that. It's about bringing your whole self to the job and not just being that stoic, you know, do it the way I said to do it. You know, you have to bring your whole self to the work.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And you know, one of the questions I had for you was, what is your definition of leadership? And it makes me think about sort of, how much does your definition of leadership include things like authenticity and vulnerability? Because those are hot buzzwords right now leaders across the U.S., I would say.
Yeah, no, you know, my definition doesn't have that, which is surprising, because I think, and when you hear my definition, you'll be a little bit surprised. And I put it in the book as well. But, you know, leadership is about 3 things, and it's about influencing people towards an objective. That's really the primary definition of leadership. So it's 3 things: influence, people, and an objective and a goal. And the problem we have in leadership is that we get lost in everything else that surrounds leadership. We get lost in our emails and our to-do list and our conference calls and our customer meetings, and we forget to talk to people and motivate them towards a goal. And so we get lost. So I think what I've been trying to do in my teaching and talking about leadership is getting people back to the basics of motivating people towards an objective and a goal. Now, how do you motivate people? Well, that's when you get into that, the areas of everybody is led differently. So everybody has a unique personality. Everybody comes from a different background, culture. There's race, there's gender, there's experience levels, and you have to lead each person uniquely. And so that motivating piece is a big, that opens up a whole window of things. But it's really just people, motivation, and a goal. And if we get back to that, I think we can be good leaders.
So how would you define your leadership style?
Well, I think I would say I'm probably, I would say I'm a player coach. So I'm definitely a coach in that I'm coaching people all the time, trying to help them get better as individuals. But I'm also willing to step on the field if I need to, and I'm not afraid to get my hands dirty. And you know, I'm running a small business now, a manufacturing business. When we get busy, I just throw my boots on, I go out on the shop floor, and I work side by side with my employees. I have a deep relationship with them. We have deep conversations while we're working the line. We talk about our future. And then, you know, when I got to get back and talk to talk to customers and get more orders, I put my other shoes on, I go back to work. So, but I think I've always been that way. I came from a blue collar background, and I think I'll always be that kind of person that's going to just dive in and help out.
Was that a tough transition for you to go from kind of blue collar worker or getting your hands dirty to management? Or executive?
Well, for me, it wasn't, but I think that's one of the key problems I see in corporate America today. Mm-hmm. Is that we have a lot of great doers, right? We have a lot of great people that are individual contributors, and they do an amazing job at their function, right? So you might have a guy who's an incredible engineer, right? And so what we do in corporate America is we find these great individual contributors, and we say, well, they'd make a great manager. So we promote the people who are great doers, and we put them in leadership roles, and they can't make that transition. So they go back to their comfort zone, which is, you know, as an engineer, right? I was a great engineer, so I'm going to go back to working on drawings and designs. And the rest of the engineering team is saying, well, you're an engineering manager now. Why are you working on drawings? What about us, right? Can we have a meeting? What's going on? So I think we do that a lot in corporate America. We take great doers and we make them leaders. And they, what they end up doing, they go back to what their comfort is, and that is doing and not leading. So I think that's part of the problem that we have with leadership. So leadership is a different animal altogether, right? You have a different role. You need to have different skill sets, and not the best doer. It doesn't always make the best leader. So I think the best leader makes the best leader. And I think sometimes we forget that.
Yeah. I've seen that a lot in exemplary sales professionals where mm-hmm. they're promoted up to sales manager and then they stumble and fall down. It makes me think of that idea of we are promoted to the point of our incompetence.
Yes. Yes, very much so.
And I think there's a lot of truth to that. And, you know, we keep wanting to climb the ladder, but we get pushed or promoted to the point where we can't do it very well anymore. And I think leadership is a skill. And I think it's a skill you definitely can learn and get better at. I also think that some people are more inclined to it than others.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
One of the things, I like your idea of the player coach. I like that response because I think of a great leader like a great coach in the sense that I think you have to know your players or your employees or personnel so well that you know how to motivate them individually. Mm-hmm. Where a lot of CEOs that I work with get into trouble is they have one leadership style, which is generally something like command and control, mm-hmm. and they just expect people to follow orders. And there's not really any emotional connection with the people that they're working with. And so they tend to get pushback after a while, or the people around them are afraid of their anger. So they turn into yes people, yes men. Mm,
and that's dangerous.
Do you see much of that? I mean,
oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, I see that a lot. I see that, that top-down management style quite a bit where we say, you know, where these leaders say, you know, do what I say. Don't, you know, they don't ask for input. They don't want their employees involved. And then, you know, I say, if you want engaged employees, you have to be an engaged boss, right? You have to ask for input. You have to follow that. You have to listen to your employees. You have to get out of your office. You have to be present. You know, I talk about that a lot. And, but those that don't, right? It's, you know, we always hear about the micromanager as the problem, and that is a problem. But there's also a thing called an absent manager. And that's the guy that, or gal, that is not there, right? That is, yeah, that's locked in their office, right? Or they're on conference calls all day long or in meetings all day long, and they have no time for their team. They have no time for their people. And so the people feel like that leader doesn't care. And that's a big problem. And so just being present, just getting out of your office and spending time with your people, they think that you care, and you do care because you're spending time with them and you're listening to them and you're having a, you know, a two-way conversation. And we have a problem with that because people think that managers should be in a conference call or in meetings. They shouldn't be with the people. And I think that's the wrong. This is the reason why 70% of employees are disengaged, because they have bosses who are disengaged.
When I've heard that, and these were stats from about 10 years ago, I think from Gallup, that said that 75% of the American workforce is disengaged.
Yes.
And that the reason they're disengaged is their direct supervisor. And that people don't typically leave companies, they leave their supervisor.
Exactly. 100%.
This is an asshole, I'm out of here.
Right, right. Yeah, no, you're 100%. And the thing is, that data hasn't changed. Year after year, it's right in that same category.
That data was 25, 50, 25. So 25% were engaged, 50% were disengaged, which is going to take it or leave it. And 25% were actively disengaged, which meant that they were stealing things. They were actively sabotaging projects. Yes. They were stabbing each other in the back, like just trying to blow things up because they were so pissed and disenfranchised, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, no, the numbers haven't changed much over the years. I mean, they've gotten a little bit better, but we're talking about, you know, a couple of percentage points. It's not, you know, it's not a 10% gain. So it hasn't changed much over the years, which means our leadership hasn't changed much over the years. And what's remarkable is there's been 15,000 books written on the subject of leadership. So we have the knowledge, right? We know what to do. we just have to do it. And a lot of times people say, well, your writings are like common sense. I said, yeah, they are, but they're uncommonly practiced these days. So,
well, I like that idea. Common sense isn't necessarily common practice, to your point.
Right.
And you know, you said, it's amazing to me when talking to executives, how much of the things, the ideas that I share with them apply to being a leader and apply to being a parent and apply to being a spouse.
Yes.
And I'm like, you know, cause I'll tell them something like, to me, a lot of this is about attention. To me, a lot of this is about emotion, that if you can emotionally connect with your employees and you're authentic and real with them, they're going to want to work for you harder.
Yes.
Generally, unless you're a complete asshole, but I mean, you know, it's really about emotional connection, authenticity, and vulnerability to me. And then, so even like take the idea of attention. We know that in marriages, this idea of bids for attention is really important. So if your spouse makes a bid for attention, hey, honey, did I tell you about blah, 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 blah? You can either ignore that. That's a neutral response. You can get irritated. That's a negative response. No, why are you always interrupting me? Or a positive response is, no, honey, you didn't. Tell me about it. That's giving her your attention.
Yes.
And they found that, you know, a healthy marriage will respond with a positive response about 2/3 of the time.
Yes.
A marriage headed for divorce, it's about 1/3 of the time. So it doesn't really matter where you are on that percentage. What matters is you become aware of it and improve. But the same thing I would apply for a leader, like you need to pay attention to what the people around you are saying. And to your point of it's listening, right? It's being there. It's not doing 5 things at once.
Correct.
Working on an email going, oh yeah, John, hold on. I'll be with you in just, no, I'm listening. Yes. I'm listening. I got you. And yes. It's the same thing with raising kids. A lot of it's about attention.
It is. So
it's interesting to me that there seems to be these layers that apply across the board.
It is. And what's interesting is one of the things in a relationship, whether it's with your children or with your spouse, right? Trust is a big issue, mm-hmm. right? And so the statistics show that an employee who trusts their boss is 12 times more likely to be engaged at work. So what does that tell you? Well, exactly what you just said. The same skills that it takes to have a good marriage, to be a good parent, ties in really well to being a good boss. It's just building that trust, having that relationship, do what you say you're going to do, be a person of your word, and being someone that can be relied upon. That I trust John as my leader, because when he said, you know, we were going to get a pay raise, we got a pay raise. When he said that, we're not sure how we're going to get through this coronavirus situation, but I'm going to be here every day, and I'll be informing you every day with what we're doing, and they know they can trust you. And so when you build that level of trust, then they're more willing to, you know, do more for you and contribute more. And so they're more engaged. I would say if you measure my level of engagement in my current job, I probably have 95% engagement. Not you can't have 100% engagement, right. Obviously, but
yeah.
I mean, everybody is bought into what we're trying to do. They understand the mission. They understand what we're trying to do. They'll work overtime just to take care of customers and get the orders out the door, because they really deeply care about the business.
Yeah, I remember I was talking with the CEO recently, and there's very few people that I look at and say, yeah, that's a man I would follow. And this guy is one of them. And he described this story where he was creating a new subsidiary and started out with 5 people, built it to 5,000. But early on, he let all the employees know that he was a man of his word, that he was acting out of integrity, had certain values that he laid out. But then there was this one key thing that he did. He said, if I find out that any of you have promoted yourself, your own career, on the backs of someone else in this organization, I will fire you on the spot.
Yes.
And then he did it the first time to a VP. And later he found out, and he did it one more time to another VP. And later, several years later, he found out from employees, they came to him and they said, you know, the first person you fired, our trust started to grow for you. The second time it happened, we knew you had our backs.
Yes.
And you know, I think of that, and I think of, like, I was talking to a friend who works at Twilio in the city, and that leadership during this pandemic has just said, go home, take care of your family. Any work that you can get done remotely right now is a bonus, but right now the priority is your family.
Yes.
And then I look at some other, there was a hotel I was reading about that, you know, the employees showed up and they fired them all on the spot. Mm. And I think, now which employee is going to say, man, I really want to come back and work hard for these guys?
Yeah.
It seems so obvious to me.
It is obvious. And I think that, I think a part of the problem is and I see it, I went to business, you know, I've got a couple of master's degrees in business and you spend a lot of time taking courses in the hard skills in business. So they want you to know sales, marketing, accounting, legal, you know, ethics. So you take all these courses in what they call hard skills, right? But nowhere in my graduate programs, and I see it because I teach at several graduate schools as well, I don't see, when I ask them how much leadership training they have, they say, well, we maybe get a lecture here or there. Mm-hmm. So we get course after course of hard skills like accounting, and we have very few courses in leadership and dealing with people, right, and the people side of the business, because they call that soft skills, right? And soft skills aren't considered a high priority. Just based on, if you just look at a curriculum for a MBA, for example. Mm-hmm. So you come away thinking that a person, people, are an expense, right? They're on the profit and loss sheet as an expense. And if you can reduce that, right, by lowering salaries or getting rid of people, you can increase your profits. And really, it's all about shareholder value, right? So we want to do that. We want to get rid of our people, and we want to increase our profits, and we want to take care of our shareholders. Really? Mm-hmm. I call BS to that because
The
priorities are wrong. If you take care of your people, right, they're going to add, they're an asset. And what I mean by an asset is they have long-term value to a company. That's what an asset is. It is a long-term value to the company. And if you take care of them, just like any other asset you have in a factory, right, I've got equipment out there, right? If I take care of it, it's going to last a long time. It's going to produce lots of great product for me. It's the same thing with people. You take care of them, they're more than just an expense on the profit and loss sheet. They bring future value to your company. I mean, I think I spent 22 years in corporate America. I brought millions and millions of dollars of value to that organization, or those, I've worked for several organizations, mm-hmm. but and I didn't make millions and millions of dollars. So I, you know what I mean? I brought that value, and our employees do that too. They bring the value as well.
And if we pull back the lens to a much broader lens of society, it makes me think about how we're socialized as men, in the sense that I think one of the big values that most of us fall prey to is the creation of wealth and, you know, providing for the family. And I see this degradation of one value over decades, over and over and over, where, you know, we start out in our 20s, 30s maybe, we want to provide for our family. That makes sense to me. Like, that's a healthy value. But then you get in the corporate world and you start getting caught up in that addiction to urgency, that need to make more money, the desire to climb the ladder.
Right.
And you stop paying attention and spending time with the very people that you set out to provide for.
Yes.
And so in the end, they get resentful and angry and, you know, they're irritable. And then it creates this problem where you've made all sorts of money, but you're not happy.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, it makes me think about how we're socialized in those prioritization of values. And I think that wealth is at the top of the value for too many people, or the top of the value hierarchy.
Yeah, I think you're right. And to be honest, I was in senior leadership roles at big, you know, global companies. I was, you know, vice president. And in a way, they trap you in that they do pay you a lot of money, right? And you do get big bonuses. And you do change your lifestyle, right? And so you feel like, well, and then they come to you and say, well, we need you to shut that plant down. We need to do this. We need to do this. And you're like, well, you know, I've got that mortgage on the house. I've got that new car that I just bought. You know, I'm gonna do what they asked me to do. Because so I think in a way, they trap people into this high level of making money, and you're making money, and you've got a certain lifestyle, and so you, okay, if you want me to do that, that's fine. I'll do it. And so you then lose a bit of yourself. I always say it's soul sucking. You lose a bit of your soul, you know, when you're in those roles and you sort of, well, I got to take care of my family, so I'm going to go do these things. And I can tell you, you know, I left corporate America. Then I went back to one other global company, and I realized when I went to that second, or that's like my actually my third global company, I went to that company, and that was the point where I realized I'm done with that. I can't live that life anymore. I can't give my soul to these companies. And starting my own business was the best thing for me because I can lead the way I want to lead. I can treat people the way I want to treat people, and I can do things with integrity in the way I want to do it.
Yeah, and I love that response. So thank you for sharing that. And it also makes me think, so I've seen several VPs that are making, to me, a healthy sum of money. And I'm wondering, so maybe you can speak to this, because I think at some level, our self-worth as men gets wrapped up in this. So, you know, you get into a position as a VP or executive VP, you're getting $500,000 a year with bonus, and then you find yourself working some ridiculous amount of hours, 100, 110, 120 mm-hmm. hours a week, partly because I think at some level we don't feel we're worth that much money. So in order to prove that we are, we just keep giving more and more of ourselves to justify it.
No, I definitely agree with you on that, because my first vice president job, when they told me the salary, and I was like, okay, I'll do that. Really? You know, I was just like, I couldn't believe it, you know, in a company car and this stuff. Yeah. And so I was enamored by that. You know, I came up, like I said, from a very blue collar background, and to think that there were jobs that paid that kind of money, I never imagined it in my life. Right. Yeah. So yeah, you're chasing that. Like, I want to prove my worth. I want to prove my value. They're paying me this much money, and I got to bring that much value to the organization. So yeah, I think you're chasing that.
The other part that enters into it, I think, is you get to that level. So the human, one of the main ways the human mind works is by comparison. So you see this from school age all the way up, where, you know, it's upward social comparison versus downward social comparison. So the upward is something like, oh man, that dude's got a better car than me, faster car, bigger biceps, hotter wife, hotter girlfriend. He's in more shape. He's making more money. He's got a better house. And every time we do those upward comparisons, we feel less than, we feel lousier.
Right.
Whereas when we do downward social comparisons, well, you know, I'm more fortunate than these people out here, and it's, you know, maybe 90% of the population or whatever it is, we feel a little bit better.
Right.
And I think we get to that level of VP or president, and we compare ourselves to others around us now, and we're like, ooh, well, he just got a pool put in his backyard, or he's got a 5,000 square foot house, or you know, he's got the new Tesla. And I think we start to want those things and feel that we're not happy unless we get those things. And we know that those things aren't necessarily going to add to happiness long-term.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that is the worst thing you do, in my mind, is to compare yourself to others, because I think no matter where you are in the food chain, there's people making more money than you, and there's people making less money than you, you know, or there's people that are, you know. And the other thing is, one of the things we have a challenge with social media, and I see it all the time, is that there's an appearance of success. So
happiness.
Everybody's happy. Everybody's, you know, the stuff I call it hustle porn. You know, you see these, they'll show entrepreneurs and they're like, hustle. And then they show a picture of them with like a fancy car and a private jet. And I'm like, I can't hustle any harder than I'm hustling right now. I'm running my business, you know? So I think some people are like attracted to that, you know, and so they're chasing something, and they're like, I'll only be happy until I get my private jet, right? Or something like that.
Well, and I think, you know, the one that kind of smacked me in the face the most abruptly about this was a guy that I knew that had, I think it was like a $50 million jet, like his own personal jet that he could fly himself and his family around. And he was unhappy or jealous of a friend that had an $80 million jet.
Of course.
And it's like,
of course.
And dude, you have a $50 million jet. Like, get some perspective.
Right.
But that's how the mind works. If you're not aware of it, it can ruin you that way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think contentment is something that we don't really talk about too much, right? My wife and I talk about this all the time. Growing up blue collar, middle or lower middle class. When you are successful later in life, right? You have a different perspective. I never went to Florida. I grew up in New England, right? And like, I'd have you know, family or friends that had family that had money, and they would go to Florida and they would go to Disney World. And I would be like, wow, someday maybe I can go to Disney World.
You could go now.
Yeah.
Real cheap.
It's
all the
empty
rides
right now.
No lines.
But I just,
you might have to sneak in, but.
But I just, I saw my friends going there, and we went camping on our family vacations because that's what we could afford, right? So now when I go, I've never went to the Grand Canyon, but I always dreamed of someday going to the Grand Canyon. Well, now, like my wife and I had, we had our two boys, we're at the Grand Canyon, and both of her and I were like, I cannot believe we're here, right? Mm-hmm. What an amazing thing. My wife and I have been to China together. We walked on the Great Wall of China together, and we were like, I cannot believe we're here. And so we're just in awe of our life, right? In appreciation of what we're able to do with what we have, right? And so I think people who maybe come up with a lot of things in their life as young, they're sort of chasing that the rest of their life. When you grow up kind of not really having much, you really appreciate what you have. And mm-hmm. and I think that's led to, at least my wife and I, we're a high level of contentment with what we have. And we're just happy that we can't believe, you know, what we've seen in our lives and what we've been able to do. And so I think we're much more appreciative of what we have.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think that appreciation and gratitude, that's such a huge daily habit to cultivate if you want to have a happier life. Just looking for three things that went well today or three things that you're grateful for. And I love the idea of contentment. I define that with my clients as the sort of mild, positive, emotional state that you're in when you stop long enough and stay in the present moment and realize that right here, right now, you have everything you need.
Yes. Yes.
Our minds are always taking us to the past and the future.
Yeah.
You know, and usually from a place of lack or scarcity, that then we quickly go into anxiety or fear, or sadness or regret. So part of it, I think, is really learning to manage the mind.
It is. I give you an example. We have a morning meeting every day here at the factory. We just huddle up around a big whiteboard. We look at and we talk about what's going to happen that during the day. And if I sense there's anxiety in the team about, you know, are we going to get some more orders or, you know, one of the things I like to say, and I smile when I say it, and I say, you know what, we got air in our lungs, we got money in the bank, it's a great day. You know, let's get it done. And I think that's kind of a mindset of just, you know, being, you know, could it be better? Yes. Could it be a lot worse? Absolutely. And, you know, we're seeing that with how do you lead during this particular corona crisis, right? There's a lot of anxiety, you know, and the best thing to do is be present and be honest and, you know, share what you know about what's happening. Ask them how they're feeling. It's just trying to be there for your team as they're trying to figure out what they're going to have to do. You know?
I think you're absolutely right. And the next step also is as leaders sharing how you feel and saying, you know what, guys, like I'm kind of anxious too. Like I don't really know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
And all we can do is do our best today, given the information that we have right now. And I'm going to be right here by your side every step of the way, trying to figure it out as we go. And we'll just keep the conversation going as we move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Sharing, I mean, it's not a weakness to share your emotions or how you're feeling about a situation. Yeah. In fact, it makes you more authentic. It makes you more
exactly.
real.
Exactly. And I think that's what really ultimately bonds us to each other is the sharing of emotion and not the pause, not like, I feel great. My life's outstanding. Like it's more about, no, here's my shit. Here's where I'm struggling.
Yeah.
Here's where I'm afraid. Here's where I'm a little bit irritated. I mean, I think that's where people go, yeah, I've felt that before. I know where he's at.
Yeah.
And now you become human and now people have an easier time connecting to you.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, I'm writing a new book right now and I've got a chapter about just the humorous side of leadership, the humorous side. And I think part of being a real person is to have the ability to laugh at yourself when things go wrong and things don't, you know, when you make a bad decision, you know, I'm all for laughing about it with my team. I'm like, yeah, remember that product line we got into? It didn't really work out too well, didn't it? That was my bad. Okay, yep. We're not going to do that anymore. Okay. So, but they see me as a human that makes mistakes, but I don't pretend like it didn't happen.
You know,
I'm willing to admit it and to, you know, to laugh about it, laugh at myself. And I think that's kind of a unique personality trait that you don't, you know, it's funny. We, on the summary, it was really unique because if you had something that bothered you, you didn't let anyone know because you'd have somebody just picking on you all the time. Submariners were.
That's the old schoolyard mentality with guys.
Absolutely.
Don't show your soft spots.
It's a locker room, right? So it's a bunch of guys that at the time. Now we have women on the submarines, but back then, and so so you learn to roll with it. You learn to laugh at your mistakes. You learn to you didn't let things offend you easily, and I think you became much more resilient. Thicker skin, and you had the ability to laugh at yourself. And I think those are really good skills because I see a lot of corporate leaders, corporate managers that take themselves way too seriously. Yes, you should take your job seriously, but don't take yourself so seriously. It's not good for your health. I'm not a doctor either.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I think, you know, what you just demonstrated was humility, honesty,
yes,
and a sense of humor about yourself. And it's interesting to me because almost every man I've spoken to in the past hates to be embarrassed. I'm always challenging them to look, we need to get more comfortable with being embarrassed. Because if you, to the extent you hate to be embarrassed, you can't laugh at yourself. You can't point out your own mistakes. Mm-hmm. You can't have people kind of poking fun at you. And I mean, we're all going to screw up. We're all going to make mistakes and we're all going to do stupid shit. And so if you can say, wow, yeah, I really screwed up there yesterday. Sorry about that. And kind of have a sense of humor about it. I think it's so much more, it helps out incredibly.
It really does. I give you an example. We've been busy in the shop with, for whatever reason, all the utilities are ordering, it must be like toilet paper. People are ordering parts that they want for the grid just in case anything happens. So we've been very busy in the shop. So I was out on the assembly line I was working on orders, and then I went out to the shop and I was helping box up some products. And I boxed up about 10, and I forgot to put one of the, there's a couple of different kits you're supposed to put in. I forgot one of the kits in every one of the boxes. And I didn't have a knife on me to open up the boxes. So I had to ask one of the guys, like, you got a knife? He's like, why, did you forget putting a part in there? I go, yeah, just give me the knife, you know. But it was a good moment. It was a bonding moment. Mm-hmm. They see the CEO out there trying to help and laughing at himself when he does something stupid, you know. And I think those are good things.
It also gives you more empathy for them when they make a mistake.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's understandable now. Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. I just did that the other day.
Right. And you also learn how can we do this better where we won't screw up, you know? And if you're not present, you never know those things. If you're sequestered in a conference room or in your office all day long, you never see those things. You never relate to those things.
So I've really enjoyed this conversation about leadership. And before we wrap up in about 10, 15 minutes, I really have to get to the sub experience because so far out of my realm of reality. And I think part of why I wanted to have you on the show was because I think you've gone from that, the man box culture, being in a sub with all men in the military, to being a CEO. And so I'm curious what that was like and how you've kind of overcome it.
Well, yeah, I don't overcome it.
Evolved past it. Fully evolve, right?
So. Right. No, I think you know, some people say that if you come from a military background, that you're going to be a command and control kind of guy, right? That you're going to say,
that's the assumption, yeah.
Yeah, you do it my way. This is my rank. You do it my way because that's the way it was in the military, right? Well, we can put that to rest right now, especially in the world I came from, which was in a submarine. So you had, you know, 140 guys in our case that would go out to sea. We'd be out to sea for 80 days at a time. You did not get to pick the crew that you went out to sea with. So imagine going to work one day and you've got 150 people or so, and you lock the hatch, you lock the doors, and nobody leaves for 80 days. This is your life. So there is no downtime. There is no you know, I used to tell my wife, I miss hearing my first name because I was always Lieutenant Rennie or Mr. Rennie. And, I craved just hearing my name, John. No, you know what I mean? It wasn't there. So you go from this environment that's, it's really, it's tight. You're close and you build these deep relationships because you stand watch. So I would stand watch in, So it'd be a room like we'd be in maneuvering. This is where we'd run the reactor from. There'd be four guys on watch, right? Myself being the officer in charge, and I have three enlisted guys. And it was the room the size of a closet, essentially. And we would spend 6 hours in there, and nothing would happen for 6 hours, right? But we would have really deep, interesting, funny conversations, and we'd build these relationships with each other. And we had deep relationships with each other. And so there was no downtime. So there was just, you were constantly with your people, constantly engaged. You come over to the civilian world, right? You come into corporate America and people go home every night, right? There isn't a sense of urgency like there was in the military, right? If you don't get it done today, you do it tomorrow, right? And then you don't have that camaraderie that you had in the military. So that was one thing I was missing. But I also, the big thing I took away from the time on the submarines and in the military in that unique environment was relationships matter, right? Get to know people, you know, spend time with them, get, you know, understand what makes them tick. You know, if you think about it this way, on a submarine, right? Your shipmate had to have your back, right? He was going to save your life if something went bad. So you had to know that he had your back. So you developed a deep relationship, but you know, if he didn't have the skills, you want to make sure that guy had the skills because they were going to back you up in an emergency, right? In the civilian world, you don't have that sense of urgency that, you know, and people don't have your back, you know, and you sense that. Like, I don't trust that person, right? You know, and so you learn those things, because on the sub, you had to have each other's back. You had to be there for each other. So I think it was difficult to make that transition early on because I definitely felt like that people were in roles that they weren't trained to be in. They were given leadership responsibilities and they had no idea how to do them. And I think that's why I gravitated towards leadership in the civilian world because I kind of felt like I looked around and I said, these guys aren't very good, right? I could do better. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been with some great leaders. So one thing that's really unique in the military, in order to advance in rank, in order to get to be a captain of a submarine, you had to have previously served in the job I was in. You had to be a junior officer. You had to come up through the ranks and you had to do all the difficult things, right? And you had to be good at it because at every level there was attrition, right? So when you get to be a captain of a submarine, an 06 in our case, so that's a true captain, Navy captain, you knew your stuff. And we, as other officers, we respected that captain because he had been in our shoes and he had leveled up, right? So then you go to a civilian company and you meet the plant manager for the first time and you're like, wait, I've got more degrees with him. I've led things longer than him. Well, I don't know about this, right? So you don't have that same level of respect that you did for the captain. Yeah. The captain clearly had been there, done that, and had the rank because he had earned it. And I think that's part of the problem too, is that you don't have that. How do I say? There is no qualification process to be a plant manager or a CEO or what have you. They'll promote people without leadership skills. And without that, they hadn't leveled up, right? They haven't done the hard things to get to this position. And that was frustrating for me when I came in initially.
Yeah, I bet. And it's interesting to me because I've heard this from several different people in different branches of the military that when you're in close quarters with men over long periods of time, you do develop these deep bonds. You do have these deep, meaningful conversations. And it makes me wonder what the difference is between that and civilian life, where it might be the space, time, and distance that we're not forced together. So it's easy to go out and have a couple drinks and then we're like, see ya, I'm going home.
Right.
Or we go to work for a couple hours, but we're not in those close quarters. We're not under fire. I mean, I've talked to, you know, Army Rangers that have been under fire in Afghanistan, and some of the closest relationships they have were guys that they were in foxholes with for eight hours at a time.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of funny, just to your point, we would go on patrol, right? We'd be out for 80 days. And, you know, some of us were married. I got married during that time. And we would get together, like the officers, we'd get together and have parties during our off crew. And what do you think would happen? You know, we all couples, we all get together. The women go in the kitchen and the men who we haven't seen our wives in 80 days. We all get together and we tell, you know, war stories, and we're having this book. And I always thought that was funny. It's like, even when we were home, we were really tight with the people that we serve with, and you know, just those deep relationships. And one thing I hear from a lot of guys getting out of the military is they miss that. And I did too. You miss that camaraderie. You miss that there was a bond between, you know, you had each other's backs and you were there for each other. And you serve, you had so much respect for your peers and so much respect for your leadership. And when that kind of goes away, you're kind of lost a little bit. You know, you're lost when you come out of the military. You don't
And I think that's hard to replicate in civilian life. I think there's a lot of men out there that are thirsty for deep, meaningful connection, meaningful conversation, men that they can trust, men that they feel safe and secure around. I think we struggle with that.
Yes. I agree with that. Yeah, we do. Yeah. Yeah, and that leads to a lot of emotional problems, a lot of divorce, a lot of men taking their own lives, even military guys. You know, that's a big problem in the veteran community right now. Is they're missing that bond, that connection, the brother. You know, and so I really appreciate the groups that are trying to connect the veterans and making sure that kind of doesn't happen. You know, so.
So let's talk. We got a few more minutes left. What pieces of masculinity do you see as effective, and which ones do you not see as effective or as less effective?
Yeah, it's funny. I don't, you know, we live in a world where we kind of, this toxic masculinity you hear about.
And, yeah, I don't say that phrase.
Yeah, I just don't understand it. I mean,
well, the reason I don't say it is because it puts men on the defensive, and that's, I don't want to do that. I just want to have a conversation to look at it with curiosity, right?
Exactly. So, I mean, you know, we're wired a certain way, right? We're wired to protect and to provide, right? And when we're doing that as men, when we're protecting and providing, we're satisfied. It's deep within our soul, if you will, to protect and provide. And at least in me, it as a leader, protect and provide is it's what I do, right? It's what I do at work. It's what I do at home. It's easy to be in that mode, right? But there are elements of masculinity that are troublesome, right? I have zero, how do I say this? Okay, here's an example. I want to know my people, but I don't have it in my brain to be able to be that social animal that will know everything about their birthday. So I have a spreadsheet, and it's maybe, but I have to have a spreadsheet that says, okay, when people's birthdays are, their children's names and all this. So I have to force myself, because that's not natural for me. Whereas I see some of the women leader in my business, they just naturally think, oh, it's his birthday, or, you know, they just remember all this stuff, and they're much more emotionally connected than we are. So I think I have to force myself into that emotional side, because I think sometimes it's easy as a man to be more stoic and to distance yourself. So I think that's problematic. But you can overcome that by, like I said, having a spreadsheet, you know, finding ways to try to overcome. That's not natural for me, right? So I have to find ways to do it. But it is natural to me to protect and to provide, right? So those are natural. So I think we have to recognize that the way we're wired is going to prevent us from doing things a certain way. So you just have to recognize that can be a weakness in some spots, like emotion, but it can be a strength when it comes to you know providing that leadership and that protection and that provision.
Yeah, I think the other one that comes to mind as you're talking, we touched on this earlier, kind of that individual contributor mentality of self-reliance, of being kind of the one-man army. I don't need anybody.
Right.
And I think that's how we're socialized as men. Typically, you know, you deal with shit on your own. I think as you were talking, I was thinking that it could be a really big hurdle in moving from individual contributor to a leadership position.
Yeah, you're right, because you can't do it alone. Mm-hmm. You can't, and if you try to do it, I talked about it earlier when I started in leadership in the civilian world, I was trying to do everything on my own. Yeah. And I learned quickly that I needed the wisdom, the collective wisdom of my team to be successful, not just my own personal knowledge. And that, I think you're right, it is a little bit hard to make that transition, because whether it's masculinity, or if it's just, you know, being an American, you know, like, I'm going to do it myself, I'm, you know.
Yeah, a little of both in there.
Yeah, so, but I think part of it is we try to do it on our own, and you know, on the boat, we couldn't do it on our own. We had to, everybody had to have each other's back, right? So I knew that. And so I think that helped me to be a little bit pre-wired to it. So when I found myself in leadership position, I knew, well, I need to have everybody involved to have my back. I can't just do it by myself.
All right. Well, John, thank you so much for this interview. I've really enjoyed it. So tell people where they can get a hold of you or get a copy of the new book that's coming out.
Okay, great. So I'm at johnsrennie.com, and that's everything's there for my social links and what have you. And it's John with no H, so johnsrennie.com. And then you can also, my first book is out. It's I Have the Watch, and you go to ihavethewatch.com, and you can get all the links for that as well. And the new book is coming out. It'll come out this year. It's called All in the Same Boat. And if you like the first book, you're going to love the second book because there's a lot more sea stories. So I tell a lot of stories about my days in the Navy. So it's and relate them to how that helped me in leading organizations in the corporate world.
Yeah, I was going to say there seems to be a theme in the books.
Yeah, well, yeah. Well, right, well, like you said, it's unique to meet a submariner, right?
It is.
Somebody that was an officer on a submarine. So I have to use that, because that's my experience.
And I got to say, I couldn't have done it. So thank you for your service because, man, I've been in those subs and just being in them makes me claustrophobic.
Yes.
Yeah, most people. So thank you.
Okay, it's an honor. It was an honor. Yeah.
All right. And that's it for this episode of The Evolved Caveman. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Evolved Caveman podcast. If you like what you've heard, support us by subscribing, leaving reviews, and sharing the podcast with friends and colleagues. For the latest, most powerful tools to connect with like-minded men, join the Facebook group at The Evolved Caveman. Follow Dr. John on Instagram at The Evolved Caveman, all one word, or join the email list by visiting guidetoself.com.